This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Welcome to Radio EcoShock. We begin with a startling way to reduce carbon in the atmosphere. Dr. Peter Kellerman of Columbia University reports in from his fieldwork in Oman. Then, are you dreaming of moving to the country? We get tips from Jill Winger at her prairie homestead in Wyoming. All that, plus a couple of answers for climate doubters from Professor Jim White in this week's Radio EcoShock. It's not enough to stop putting fossil emissions into the atmosphere. Somehow we have to reduce the levels of carbon dioxide, currently running around 410 parts per million. When we are finally ready to save ourselves from climate change, Peter Kellerman may have part of the solution. The answer lies in an unlikely place, the Sultanate of Oman. The country is south of Saudi Arabia and is the eastern neighbor of Yemen. Dr. Kellerman has been there many times over the years as part of the Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory at Columbia University. Peter leads an international group of scientists studying a rare and beneficial rock formation that can gulp down CO2 and hold it. Dr. Peter Kellerman is a professor of geochemistry at Columbia University in New York and chair of Earth and Environmental Sciences. From Oman, Peter Kellerman, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, thank you very much.
Why go to Oman? Why not find these rocks in other places?
Well, these rocks are in other places, but the world's largest outcrop of these rocks from the Earth's interior is here in Oman. And in addition, of course, the climate is very arid and there's very little vegetation, so we can see the rocks very well. And finally, some of the carbonate deposits that form when the air interacts with these rocks would be dissolved and sort of pushed underground, if you like, in British Columbia or along the U.S. West Coast, where we have lots of cold rainwater and snow. But here in Oman, they stick around on the surface where we can observe them.
I always assumed the inner Earth somehow communicated with the outer Earth. I mean, volcanoes release molten rock from below. Parts of the seabed, we know, fall back down. How is it possible there can be a layer that has never really come in contact with our atmosphere?
Well, that's a great question. But the process of subduction that returns rocks from the Earth's surface into the convecting Earth's interior is pretty slow geologically. And there are, on the way down, fluids are released that carry a lot of the volatiles, oxygen and carbon and such, back up into a fairly restricted volume of the mantle above subduction zones. And so the great part of the convecting mantle that, for example, feeds the mid-ocean ridge volcanoes, they have kind of a one-way transfer. Lava's coming out, but nothing's going in.
And what are the rocks that you're interested in, Oman? What do they look like, and how did they get there?
Well, what do they look like? They're kind of rusty red when you see them on the surface, because they have quite a bit of iron in them, and when that interacts with the air, that iron is oxidized and makes a kind of rust color on the surface. When you break them open, if they're not very reacted with the atmosphere, they're kind of nice green, translucent color. And then when they've reacted with the atmosphere and oxidized a little bit, they're sort of black. How did they get there? The oceanic crust offshore of Arabia about 100 million years ago, rather than being subducted beneath the continent, as is happening, for example, in southern British Columbia, those rocks were hot and buoyant, and they were thrust up onto the Arabian continental margin. So there's a big block of oceanic crust and what we call the mantle, the Earth's interior, oceanic upper mantle, thrust onto the Arabian continent. It goes for about 350 kilometers along the north coast of Oman.
Could you please explain to us the process of how these rocks can absorb generous amounts of carbon dioxide?
Yeah, so the main mineral composing these rocks from the mantle is olivine. Some of you may know it by the gemstone named peridot. It's a birthstone, I think, for October or August or something. And that gives the rock the name peridotite. So when peridotite is exposed on the surface, it reacts with the water to form serpentine minerals. It reacts with oxygen to form iron oxide minerals, and it reacts with CO2 to form magnesium carbonates, calcium carbonates, basically limestone, and you could call it marble. So in the rocks we're drilling right now, every single magnesium atom has made friends with the CO2, and the silicon that was in the olivine is just present as SiO2, free quartz.
And what happens to that CO2? Can the rocks hold it for long?
The rocks can hold it for thousands of years, basically forever on a human time scale.
What are the visual signs that I saw in a video that Columbia released that carbon's already being grabbed by the rocks in Oman?
That's right. So we see two kinds of carbonate deposits, magnesium carbonate and calcium carbonate solid deposits. One are travertines that form on the surface, great big flat plateaus of calcium carbonate with little rim pools. If any of your listeners have been to Mammoth Hot Springs in Yellowstone or the geysers in Iceland, you've seen these. So those surficial deposits are pretty extensive in Oman. And then in the subsurface, the carbonate minerals that form fill cracks and make veins that are eventually exposed by erosion, so we can study those on the surface as well.
Usually, Dr. Kelman, we think of geological processes like weathering taking thousands of years, if not much longer. Can these rocks act in any meaningful time frame?
Well, they're sucking down about 100,000 tons of CO2 a year now, which is indeed quite small compared with the human output of CO2, which is something like 40 billion tons a year. But there are experimental studies that show that the natural process here in Oman can be accelerated by a factor of about 1 million. And you can potentially achieve rates of 1 billion tons a year by emulating the natural process, but exposing more of the rock to near surface waters.
So that would be, say, about a 1/40th of our current production?
1 billion tons a year per cubic kilometer of rock. I don't think we should aspire to take the whole world's CO2 output in this way. It's one of many things that we can do, each one of which in parallel could amount to some kind of significant offset of our emissions.
Now, are we sure that we could capture more carbon than the emissions required for the technology to speed up the process?
Oh, yeah, but that's part of the challenge. So what we're studying here in Oman is a natural process. It doesn't require any input of energy or cost at all. And so what we'd like to do is understand that spontaneous natural process and come up with engineered methods that emulate that natural process as closely as possible in order to have the minimum amount of energy input and the minimum cost.
Now, I found in my research a document saying that in 2012, a group was seeking funding to do more drilling into the rock, to do more research. Did that come about?
Well, yes. I mean, we are here in Oman working on the Oman Drilling Project. It's sponsored by the International Continental Drilling Program and many other funding agencies from all around the world, NASA and the National Science Foundation in the U.S., the European Science Foundation, the Swiss Science Foundation, German Science Foundation, and the Japanese Marine Science and Technology Center. So there are 40 principal investigators. There's right now 133 people signed up to participate from 8 different countries. And they have a variety of different interests, ranging from the formation of the oceanic crust at the mid-ocean spreading ridges to interaction of hot seawater with the crust near the ridges, to the thrusting event that pushed that stuff up onto the Arabian continental platform and the chemical transfer that occurred at that time. And then weathering, you could say, so the present-day uptake of CO2 and water and oxygen by interaction with the atmosphere. And finally, there's a group of people who are particularly interested in the subsurface microbial ecosystem in these rocks, because the disequilibrium between rocks from the mantle and the atmosphere provides a source of energy that is the bottom of the food chain for these chemosynthetic ecosystems that exist in the subsurface here.
So you're saying there is life deep in the earth that has never come in contact with the atmosphere?
Only through these groundwaters and so on circulating through the rocks. I mean, the rest of life on the earth has at the base of the food chain photosynthesis, but in the deep subsurface, the base of the food chain is so-called chemosynthesis. There are microbes that eat rocks, you could say.
So Oman's a pretty hot place. Do those temperatures assist or hinder the carbon absorption process?
They certainly assist the carbon absorption process. The mean annual temperature here is 30 degrees centigrade, and that there is a temperature relationship that the hotter it is, up to about 180 degrees centigrade, the faster the reactions go. So I'm sure that things are happening a little bit faster here in Oman. The other thing that may be pretty helpful in Oman is evaporation, so that waters near the surface are evaporating within the rocks and depositing all the things that are dissolved in them, including carbonate minerals. So that probably enhances the weathering process.
Now, you mentioned that it's possible we could speed up this process up to a million times. What do we have to do that?
Well, the best thing to do, well, there's a couple things. If we had a source of purified CO2 via, for example, capture of carbon dioxide from smokestacks, then you could raise the partial pressure of carbon dioxide in the subsurface, and that increases the rate by a factor of about 1,000. And you can access hot parts. As your listeners probably know, the Earth gets hotter as you go down, and so the temperature is much higher a few kilometers below the surface. So we can access those warmer rocks, and that also can enhance the rate by a factor of about 1,000.
And Oman produces a lot of oil, and I gather it burns oil for all its electricity needs and air conditioning and all that. Could this process help Oman go for a carbon neutral economy, or even better, if that is one of the sources of carbon dioxide?
Well, that was under discussion a few years ago. The main oil company here is called Petroleum Development Oman. And for a while, they were talking to us because they were considering having as a goal to be carbon neutral as a company. But they changed their minds about that about 2010. And right now in Oman, there's some caution about this because some people feel that there's reputational damage associated with taking out the garbage for the world. And they would point to countries that take electronic waste and the damage to the reputation that those companies have suffered. And they would say, maybe this isn't a good thing for Oman to do. So right now, in the Oman drilling program, we're just studying the natural process. We're not doing any experiments on injection of purified CO2 or anything like that. And the Omanis, it's their country, it's their decision, and maybe someday in the future they'll do some experiments and maybe even try to do this on an industrial scale. But for now, they're not ready to do that.
Would we call this geoengineering or not?
Yeah. Well, you can call it geoengineering. It certainly is geoengineering. Geoengineering, in some circles, is a pejorative term associated with, for example, with putting lots of reflective particles in the stratosphere and reflecting sunlight back into space, which is potentially a fairly dangerous thing to do. I think that the process of speeding up taking CO2 and making it into solid carbonate minerals is comparatively very benign, but it certainly involves engineering, and it's certainly geological. So it's geoengineering.
Have you had any interest from other national governments?
I wouldn't really characterize it as active interest. Now, of course, the government of Iceland is very much involved with a similar project where they're at one of the power plants. They actually produce pure CO2 as a byproduct from their geothermal power plants. And they just finished a small pilot study where they reinjected that CO2 in a slightly different kind of rock. Lava derived from the Earth's interior. And they had very promising results. Basically, all the CO2 they injected disappeared along the flow path of the fluids and presumably was mineralized, formed solid carbonate mineral. So now they're going to scale up. And I'm not familiar with the details, but they're certainly planning to get rid of all their CO2 waste stream in a big project to convert that into carbonate minerals.
Have you looked at any models or projections of what it would cost and what it would take to really get this going and get as much carbon as we could out of the atmosphere and into those rocks that you're studying?
Yeah, there's a couple of different things we can talk about. Using purified CO2, of course, there's a cost up front for the process of capturing carbon dioxide from smokestack gas or wherever. But if that were available to us, I think that we could achieve solid storage for something in the neighborhood of $50 a ton of CO2. We're a little bit more ambitious. We don't think that that's going to happen at scale anytime soon, because if carbon dioxide capture and storage were to take off, it's so much better understood how to inject that CO2 into subsurface pore space, into depleted oil reservoirs or sub-deep saline aquifers. So that's almost surely the first direction that a large-scale carbon dioxide and storage regime would go. So we're more interested at the moment in direct carbon capture from air, where you would circulate seawater through these rocks, remove the carbon dioxide from that water, and then return the carbon-depleted water to the sea surface, where it would draw down carbon dioxide from the air. In that context, we think that this might be the least expensive way to directly remove CO2 from the atmosphere.
Would there be any risk to nature if that route was taken?
Not really, no. I mean, you could turn it off any time, really. And taking 100 parts per million CO2 out of the air is a prodigious project. So long before you reduce CO2 to some kind of dangerous level, you would stop. So energy use globally continues to increase by about 3% per year. It's almost all supplied by using fossil fuels of one kind or another. So emissions are also continuing to increase by about 3% per year. Even though, I mean, per capita emissions are falling in Europe and the United States, largely due to the big shift from coal to gas. But in the developing world, that hasn't happened. And so CO2 emissions continue to go up. And atmospheric CO2 concentrations continue to go up despite the focus on this. So most of us, including the IPCC, think that the atmosphere will probably go too high, that the levels of CO2 in the atmosphere might exceed 500 or even 600 ppm in this century. And it could be that that's too much. I mean, no one's totally sure about the economic consequences of this, but it could be too much for a sustainable future, in which case we'll have to find a way to remove CO2 from the air. And that's more difficult than capturing CO2 from a smokestack, because the air is, 200 times more dilute than smokestack gas. But it's possible, and it's not so terribly expensive. And so it's in that context that we're considering how we might use these rocks to directly capture CO2 from air.
It must be a little bit surreal to see that we have a problem right now. I mean, it's obvious in the changes in the weather and in so many things that scientists can measure, and yet we're not ready to do anything about it. So you're working for a possible future.
Well, that's right. You know, the thing is, I think in the United States, a majority of people are persuaded that human emissions are causing climate change. What they're not sure about is how much they should spend to fix it. And that's a pretty complicated question, because you add the uncertainty of exactly how the climate will change to the uncertainty of what sort of crops might be affected, what the damage is due to sea level rise, and so on. And you have quite an uncertain scenario. And so people aren't quite sure how much it's worth to try and mitigate that. So that's understandable, but I expect it will change over time. So let's make the analogy to building sewers. London didn't have any sewers until the second half of the 19th century. And then they spent about 2% of GDP over 10 years to dig up all the major streets in the world's largest city and install sewers. So no one's looking in the rearview mirror and saying, wow, that was a waste of money. So when people think that putting CO2 in the air is like throwing poop in the street, then the cost for CO2 management will seem quite reasonable. Until then, I don't know if we're going to really attack this problem at full scale.
Until it floods our streets. You know, one of the wonders of science, and I was reminded about this while researching your work, and that's the difference between the thickness of the Earth's crust under the continents and under the oceans. I thought it was sort of all one uniform layer, but it's not. Why did that happen? Why is it thinner under the oceans?
Well, that's a great question. So the oceanic crust is formed along a chain of volcanoes that spans the world at the mid-ocean ridges. So anybody these days can go online and get a map of the Earth's surface, including below the sea, and you'll see these shallow regions going around approximately in the center of all the ocean basins. So those, it's like a steel factory. Those volcanic ridges are producing new oceanic crust like ingots of steel flowing away from the foundry. And that material, when it first forms, is hot and buoyant, but as it cools, it becomes denser than the underlying mantle, and it falls back into the earth. And it falls back along the subduction zones, so that it never sticks around very long. The oldest oceanic crust on the surface, other than things that get pushed up on the continents, the oldest oceanic crust on the surface of the earth is about 180 million years old, and after that, it vanishes. The continental crust is buoyant with respect to the underlying mantle, and so that's why parts of the continental crust have been with us for 4 billion years. So continental crust kind of accumulates on the surface. Oceanic crust gets dense and sinks back in. And over those billions of years, the continental crust has gotten quite thick and extensive, but the oceanic crust has pretty much maintained its original thickness that forms at the ridges.
Well, I'm fairly old and fairly educated and did not know that until this very moment, so I sure appreciate that.
Okay, well, look, I mean, Google, have your readers, you Google seafloor spreading. That's a good place to start. But it's, you know, you're not alone. And the concept that I've just explained to you, first of all, is about as close as science ever comes to just facts, not theory. Secondly, it wasn't discovered until when people speculated about continental drift, but seafloor spreading and the meaning of subduction zones wasn't apparent until after I was born in 1956. And it was still not accepted in wide parts of the geological community when I entered high school in the late 60s. So it's an amazingly young scientific theory, but I don't think there's anybody anymore who's educated in geoscience who would doubt it.
I'm just reading other new science about the interaction of the Earth's crust and the mantle, and it stimulates in me this wonder that we spend so much money exploring other planets, and we still have so much to discover about our own planet. Your thoughts?
Isn't that interesting? Why is it that dinosaurs and planets stimulate so much interest, but the bottom of the ocean and the Earth's interior are less popular topics for, what's the word I'm looking for?
Research investment?
Well, research investment, we do okay. But yeah, it's just, especially as budgets tighten all over the developed world, we are looking at a funding situation in which societal relevance and the excitement of specific topics on television drive a lot of funding decisions. And so in that context, it is a little painful that people don't find the bottom of the ocean more interesting.
Now, I did find your work published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences in 2008, titled In Situ Carbonation of Peridotite for CO2 Storage. Have you made some progress in the years since then?
Oh, yeah. So we have a paper in Annual Reviews of Earth and Planetary Sciences that you can find. And then we've had a number of specialist articles in all kinds of scientific journals right up until this year. I'm not going to list them all, but these days, everybody has access to Google Scholar, and if you just type my name in there, you'll find them.
Is there anything else that you would like to tell us as we wrap up here?
Just that I guess everybody should realize that scientists are out here doing our best to come up with a whole palette of possible solutions to the greenhouse gas problem, and no one really knows which ones would ultimately emerge as the most successful. And so all we can hope is that these different projects will be allowed to go forward in parallel and mature and be ready when people need them or want them.
And I hope that's soon. From his fieldwork in Oman, our guest is Dr. Peter Kellerman from the University of Columbia. You can find out more using links in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. I'll lead you to some articles and videos about all this. Dr. Kellerman, it's been an honor to have you on Radio EcoShock.
Well, thanks a lot. It's been a real pleasure talking with you.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. There's out there, and then there's homesteading way out there, like Jill Winger and her family in Wyoming. They call themselves the Prairie Homesteader. I've been getting Jill's free Homestead Toolbox newsletter for about a year now. After a bunch of useful tips and honest writing about what works and what doesn't, I think it's time we meet her. Jill Winger, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hey, Alex, I'm thrilled to be here today.
Well, it's cool to have you. So when did you leave city life to pursue your country dream?
Well, so it's been a little bit of a process. I was actually was 18 years old when I decided I was going to leave home and go right to Wyoming. And I really didn't come to Wyoming with the intention of being a homesteader or, you know, being out in the middle of nowhere. I really just came to ride horses. I've always been a horse girl. And so horses brought me to the Wild West, if you want to call it that. And then it kind of morphed into this fascination with country living and buy our own property, and then the rest is history.
Did it take a while to plan out where and how you would do this?
You know, sometimes it does. For some people, you know, I know they do a lot of planning and the process. For us, I kind of like to say we just sort of fell into it. When we were newlyweds, my husband and I, we were looking at properties. He was a city boy as well growing up, and I was raised in town, but we had always wanted to live more rurally than where we were raised. And so we started to look at properties for our first starter home, and we knew we wanted acreage to keep up with my horse habit. And so we found this little chunk of ground, about 67 acres. It had some outbuildings. It was completely run down, just pretty much a mess. And we thought, well, it'll be a project, but it'll be good because we'll have land to keep our horses. And then almost simultaneously, you know, we closed on the property, and I just started becoming obsessed with this idea of what if this property could feed us or create an income for us? Like, what are the possibilities? And I got so excited that I started almost overnight researching things like compost piles and, you know, milk goats and growing vegetables. And yeah, it just progressed from there.
And what would you say the first biggest challenges are when moving to the country, you know?
Yeah, I think the biggest challenge, there's lots, just like any adventure, there's lots of things to overcome. But for us, it was becoming overwhelmed because there's so much to focus on at once. And so here we were in this with this tumble down property. We had fence lines to fix. We had roofs on buildings that were falling apart. You know, we were trying to get things set up, and it was deciding what are we going to do first, what's most important, and then being okay with knowing that some of the projects were just going to have to wait and be dealt with later. So it was this balancing act of, you know, we were still working jobs in town, my husband and I both at the time. So we'd work, you know, the normal jobs and try to smash in as many projects as we could on the weekends and the weeknights. And so it was a little bit crazy, especially during those first few years. Things changed moving on, but I know I see a lot of people with similar situations, and they're going, you know, which projects do I do and how do I fit this into my, you know, my modern life, because we all are still in the modern world, or at least most of us are. So there's things to balance.
And, you know, I totally agree, though, with your plan to move forward with something that was really affordable. It's such a mistake when I hear about people who move to the country thinking they're going to pay off a big property debt somehow, and good jobs are few there. So you kind of avoided that pitfall.
We did, yeah. We borrowed, you know, we've always been really passionate about debt-free and living within our means, and that really served us well as we started into this homesteading life. We purchased a property and borrowed far less than what we were approved for, which honestly yielded a, like I mentioned, a property that wasn't super impressive to our friends when we first bought it. And we showed them pictures and they're like, oh, that's nice. Because it was pretty ugly, but, you know, it was that sweat equity, and it really paid off because it enabled us to have more capital to put into the projects and not be tied down with a ton of debt.
Yeah, one of the reasons I really like your blog, and one of the reasons I called you, is you have the honesty to admit when it is hard or when things fail. And one example is I don't like weeding. I like to feed my soil, so I do mulch my garden heavily. But I wasn't watching for a serious problem that you warned me about in that heartbreaking blog titled, I Think I Poisoned My Garden. What happened there?
Oh my goodness, it was so sad. So a couple of years ago, I came across this pretty awesome idea of deep mulching. And so it wasn't thought up by me. It was thought up by a woman named Ruth Stout in the 70s. And she would layer her garden with many layers of hay, straw, or similar organic materials and create this amazing cover for the soil. It would feed the soil. It would reduce weeds, and it would reduce the amount of water you needed. So I started to experiment with that method, and I had some really good results for a couple of years. I really choked out a lot of my weeds, so I have less weeding. I stopped tilling for a good, I think there was 3 years, I never had to get the rototiller out. And the soil would be soft and spongy. It was full of worms, and it just was awesome. So I went along my merry way. I would get hay from local growers, and it was usually older hay, and I'd put, you know, put the old stale hay on the garden. And then last year, I noticed that a lot of my plants were really looking stunted, especially my tomatoes. They had this bizarre curling of the leaves, and they weren't dying, and they weren't dried out, or it wasn't like they were burned by compost or, you know, dehydrated, like some of the issues we might think of first when something happens in the garden. So I started to research a little bit and look at the symptoms of some of my plants, and I realized that the hay I had been using, unbeknownst to me, had been sprayed in its lifetime at some point with a type of herbicide in the aminopyrrolid family. And I had never heard of that before. It's a crazy, you know, crazy word. I had to totally acquaint myself with that. But in essence, those herbicides last for a very long time on hay. They're a broadleaf herbicide, so it doesn't hurt the grass it's sprayed on, but it will kill any broadleaf weeds that it comes in contact with. And it lasts a long time. It can actually even go through the digestive tracts of animals. So if you feed an animal sprayed hay and then you put their composted manure on your garden, you could potentially have issues there. So I pretty much ruined the garden last year. It was a tough lesson. We're regrouping now. I think we're going to try some raised beds and be very, very careful with what we put in the beds from here on out. But it was, yeah, it was hard. It was definitely a big fail in the garden last year.
Well, I just got a big bale of straw delivered, and it was all compressed, and it's worked great. But I didn't have a check for that, and now anything I get from here on in, I'm going to ask for sure what's been on this.
Absolutely.
You also wrote an article called, I'm Teaching My Kids to Fail, and that sounds so counterintuitive. What did you mean by that?
Yeah, it is a little counterintuitive, especially in our culture these days. And it's all about, you know, participation trophies and things like that. But in my own journey, especially as like a business owner and an entrepreneur, I've learned that some of my biggest successes usually come on the heels of a big failure. And I really started to become fascinated with that concept because I've noticed in myself or with people that I work with, a lot of times it's really tempting to just want to quit. You know, you mess something up, you fail, you embarrass yourself, and it's really tempting to say, you know, I wasn't meant to do that. It wasn't meant for me. I'm going to just cut my losses and move on. And I've realized that so many times looking back, if I had done that at those points in my life where I did fail, that I would have missed out on some of my greatest successes. And so I've really started to apply that with my kids. And of course, it's hard as a parent because they're our kids and we want to protect them and we want to shelter them from hard things in life. But so it's a little bit of a balance. You have to use common sense. But I really have been conscious of letting my kids try and sometimes letting them feel the failure and letting them know that's okay. It's something that is natural, it's normal, and even celebrating the failure sometimes. But it's not a thing to be scared of. It's just a part of the process. And I really feel like if you're not failing, you're not trying hard enough sometimes.
I got to agree with you totally. And speaking of kids, it's hard to realize that they may not choose the same lifestyle when they get older. It's so true. My own daughter spent her youngest years on our big homestead, and later she lived in the city. But more recently, she moved back to a small town and back to raising food and permaculture and all that. So we don't know how much sticks with our kids, but it may be a lot. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that's the my goal is to pass along the principles that make homesteading so special to us. You know, the principles of hard work, of being confident, of trying, of understanding failure is not permanent. And, you know, I think about that a lot because I definitely, my husband and I both went completely opposite directions than our parents did. So I'm like, I often wonder, you know, what if my kids do the same? They go the complete opposite direction that we did and say, see you, Mom and Dad, we're going to New York and we're going to make our way in the big city. And you know, if that's what they're called to do, I'm okay with that. I just hope and pray that the lessons they've learned here on the homestead, the work ethic, the integrity, as long as they take those with them, I'm okay with that.
My wife and I used to joke about that. We thought maybe we should wear suits and ties and tell our kids we were accountants so that they would do the opposite. But anyway.
Exactly.
Well, One thing I did notice, though, is when we lived in the country, as the kids got older, getting into high school, the parents ended up like a taxi service. Kids want to play sports. They want to participate. They want to go all sorts of places. So that's a stage you may have to look forward to where you are.
That's something we're kind of gearing up for. Our oldest is only six, so we have a little bit of time, but it is important for us for them to be involved in things like 4-H or sports or other activities. So I imagine we are going to be on the road more here in the future.
And there may be an arc of age when it comes to homesteading. Once a homestead's set up and operating, some people do stay there well into their old age. I knew an older woman, 84, looking after cows by herself. But to set one up, as you and your husband did, it really needs younger people, I think, so that maybe we need a kind of guide for homesteading for seniors. You know, what are the boundaries? What are you really going to be able to do? How can you get back to the country?
You know, I think that all ages can do this. I do have readers that are definitely older than I am that are doing this successfully. But I think, like you said, I think it might be one of those things where you maybe purchase something that's a little more established. You're not out there having to drill post holes and pack around hay bales and things. And, you know, there's lots of things like chickens or raised beds, gardens, and things along those lines that aren't quite as labor intensive. So I think it can be done, just maybe in a different version.
Yeah, I agree with you. Well, we're trying it. We're back in the country, and we'll see how it goes.
Radio EcoShock.
So this is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We're talking with the prairie homesteader, Jill Winger. I liked your tips on chickens and chicken coops. You know, even some vegetarians realize it's good to get protein from chicken eggs. But here's my question. Can we have chickens without buying big bags of feed from some industrial supplier?
Well, yes and no, depending on who you talk to. First off, I say yes because chickens have been kept for hundreds of years without big box feed stores. So it is possible. It's not sometimes as simple as people think that you can just turn them out to free range any old place and expect the chickens to produce optimally. And sometimes if we do have these breeds who have been bred for maximum egg production or maximum meat production, they do need a special diet to help them live to their potential. You know, I think I like to do a little bit of a hybrid. We do purchase a custom mix organic feed from a local feed store, and we give our flock that. But we also like to free range them when we can and give them scraps from the kitchen or leftover milk from the cow. And so we do a little bit of both, and that does cut down our feed bill. But it does ensure also they are getting those nutrients they need. Because I know at least here in Wyoming, there's a lot of months out of the year. There's not a lot of bugs. There's not a lot of foliage. And if I just expected them to free range and forage the entire year, we'd have some issues.
You certainly would. There's a few predators might be out there too.
Yes, we do have predator problems on occasion.
All right, now here's another topic that I really didn't know much about, and in fact, I'm only getting into it a bit because of your blog. So tell us, what is an essential oil, and why are you so into it?
Yeah, great question. So essential oil is basically a steam-distilled plant, and not all plants can become essential oils, but many of them do have enough of those volatile oils in the plant matter that they can be distilled and then those oils can then be put into a bottle and we can use them in that concentrated form. And so I started using essential oils about 5 years ago, and I really was looking at them more for ways to support my family's health. So, you know, I like natural things. I like things from the earth, things from plants that really fits with my homesteader mentality. So I looked at these little bottles of basically, you know, plant extracts, but steam distilled, and I thought, this is pretty intriguing. And, you know, fast forward to where we are now, and I use essential oils daily on the homestead. They really come in handy. We're far from town. It's not easy to run to the store if one of us is under the weather, and so it's very handy to have them to support health with my kids or myself or my husband when we need them. And I use them on the animals, too. I make fly sprays, garden sprays. We make little salves for animals who might have some skin issues, and so they're very, very handy. They're compact. I feel like they're very cost-effective because a little bottle goes a really long way. So I think it's a really awesome homesteader tool.
Are you making them? Are you selling them? What's your relationship with them now?
I don't make them because it's really quite the process. It takes a lot of raw plant matter to make a tiny bit of oil. So it's kind of beyond my scope. But I do work with a company I love, and I am a distributor. So I get to work with a lot of different people and help them learn to use the oils on their homesteads and their families and so on.
Have you published any books?
I do. I do have an ebook that's actually free. about essential oils, but that's accessible on the blog for anybody who's interested.
Cool. Well, you know, the internet changes the whole dynamics of making a living in the country. My wife works from our rural home, and I can do my radio program from outside the big city. I'm blessed to be able to just look out and look at these gigantic hills around me. How are you using social media and the net?
You know, when we first started the homestead, I worked in town, my husband worked in town, and it really was our intention that that would be the way life would go, because that's just how it works, right? Actually, when I started the blog, it was begun with the intention of being a journal of our life, but it started to take off. I started to really invest time and energy into it, and it started to create an income. I was providing value to people, and they were wanting to buy books that I was publishing or products I was promoting, and so it was kind of awesome to have that income flow in. And so I kept at it. It was kind of a process, but where we are today is my husband now is home with a family full time, and I work from home. And the blog and our essential oil business, actually, they support us full time, and they've allowed us to really take our goals and dreams to the next level and accomplish things a lot faster than we had ever planned. So it's awesome to be able to live our dream life, you know, here on the property, here with our animals, and then to be able to create that income here all at the same time.
All right. Now, Jill, who do you think your audience is? Is it more women, more men, people already in the country, or people who are dreaming of getting out of the city? What do you think?
I have a little bit of everything, but definitely more women who are dreaming, I think, or maybe who have started a garden in their backyard or have a chicken or two and are ready to kind of dive in a little deeper. Those are the bulk of my audience, I believe.
And people think of Wyoming as kind of a harsh place at times. Sure, it's big sky country, but isn't it also a tough environment to get by it?
It is. It's not what I would call your perfect homesteading mecca. It's definitely a little rugged sometimes. Yeah, so people often, you know, also I'll post pictures that look really romantic or pretty, and they'll email me and say, I want to move to Wyoming. And I'm like, oh, wait, because it's not really the most easy place to homestead, but it can be done. I think it can be done everywhere if you're willing to adapt. So here in Wyoming, we have to deal with harsh winters, wind, and snow, but we still get the job done. We just have to take some things into consideration.
Tell us about the weekly Homestead Toolbox newsletter.
So I started that a couple of years ago, and it's really been a hit. People can sign up for the newsletter for free through the blog, and then every Wednesday morning, I send out a short email that has 4 to 5 little bites of homestead information. So I know everyone's really busy, and so I know I don't like to read super long emails, and so I keep mine pretty short. But you can expect to find little recipes, tutorials, little tidbits about what we're doing that week on our homestead, and just little things to kind of, the toolbox, right, just to keep people moving forward in their dreams and giving them the practical tools that they need. So it's been really fun. People have been very receptive towards it.
Well, when we moved from the city to the country, I found that neighbors were an essential lifeline for country living, and I learned some of my survival skills just from the people who had already been there for a long time, some of the older families. How is your relationship with the local community?
Yeah, we have awesome neighbors. And so we don't have a ton of necessarily people I would call homesteaders here, but we have a lot of farmers and ranchers who make their living farming and ranching, and so they're amazing resources. And we definitely depend on our neighbors a lot for things like helping us with chores, helping us with cattle projects and things like that. So I feel like that's a huge benefit of country living, to be able to tap into that. It's a different atmosphere than I remember neighbors growing up in our neighborhood, you know, as a child, just a different dynamic. And our neighbors are sometimes 15, 20 miles away, but we still call them neighbors, and they're the people we call if we're in a bind. And so I love that part of this lifestyle. It's really that old-fashioned camaraderie.
And the National Weather Service is predicting a hot, dry summer ahead. How's your water supply?
It can be rough sometimes. We've had our drought years for sure. Our wells usually do okay, but there is definitely years where I'll stop watering the lawn and things get pretty brown and we just keep the garden going and that's about it. So hopefully, you know, we're kind of dry right now, but we usually get some good moisture in April and May, so my fingers are crossed.
I put a big water tank next to our house, and we collect everything off the eaves, and that's working out pretty well.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah, it didn't cost that much. It was just a used tank, and it's clean, water safe. Anyway, so like your homestead is 45 miles from the nearest grocery store, how does that change the dynamics of bulk purchasing, home food storage, and canning and all that?
So we definitely buy things in bulk. beside the fact that the store is a ways away, I don't like going to town usually. So I try to avoid frequent trips. But yeah, I buy things in bulk and I love to make things myself. So at any given time, I have lots of ingredients, but not a lot of prepackaged food, which is just how we're used to living. And I think it's actually made me a better cook because, you know, if we get a craving for something like ice cream or pizza, we can't just run to the store and get it. We have to figure out how to make it ourselves from sometimes creative ingredients. And so I think it's helped my culinary skills a little bit to be so isolated.
Jill, what's your view of how society is going? Do you want to be prepared in case the economy goes bad?
Yeah, we do think of that sometimes. I think there are some things we could do personally to improve our preparedness, but we do have some things in place. We do. My husband and I do have those conversations frequently of, you know, being aware and being prepared. You never know. There's lots of what-ifs out there.
I like to be prepared, but I like to think, too, that I'm just doing what I love to do anyway. So if the economy goes really great, fine. I'm enjoying my gardening. And if it doesn't, well, we can supplement our food bill tremendously.
Exactly. And that's our thoughts. You know, I wouldn't be doing this if it was just out of a place of, you know, we have to do it to get ready for whatever's going to happen. I don't think I would enjoy it. But we do it from a place of this is what we love. This is our quality of life. And if it helps us be more prepared in the process, even better.
Well, you have a lot going. Do you have some new projects in mind?
Yes, I'm actually working on a big project. I can't quite say what it is yet, but it's something that people have been requesting for a while. So it's in the works. It'll be a big project for this year, but I'm really ready to present that to everyone.
All right. And I know you do some speaking around the country. What sort of topics do you cover when you go out there?
Generally, when I travel for speaking, it's about essential oils. And that's my most common topic. We talk about oils for homesteading and oils for, you know, home remedies and things like that. But I do leave the homestead every once in a while, and yeah, I do some traveling with that. It's pretty fun.
Is there anything else that you would like to tell our listeners? Maybe I've missed something or another topic you're really interested in.
I think we covered everything well. Just a little bit of encouragement that if anyone's out there and they've been dreaming about chickens or mason jars or canning, just dive in. And I especially encourage people not to wait till the time is perfect, because there'll never be the perfect time. So if you're drawn to that, you're called to that, figure out what you can do now to start getting moving towards your goals and just take those little baby steps. It's really rewarding, and I think people are usually surprised at how much they'll learn in the process.
Yeah, I think one way to approach that too is to consider renting. There's a lot of places for rent in the country. You can try it out, see how you're doing, and then figure out from there where a good place for you might be.
Absolutely, yes.
I've been talking with Jill Winger, and from her 67-acre patch of Wyoming, Jill tells us about their family adventures on the Prairie Homestead. And you can find out more at theprairiehomestead.com, and their Homestead Toolbox newsletter is free. It's useful. It doesn't overload my inbox, so you can sign up at the site. And you'll find more links in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Jill, thank you so much for sharing with us.
Thank you, Alex. It's been a pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
I'm a longtime fan of TUC Radio in San Francisco. It's Time of Useful Consciousness, presented by Maria Gallardin. We just have an excerpt from her program featuring Dr. Jim White and two of his answers for climate doubters. Like this guy, Scott Pruitt, the new climate-doubting head of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. Here is Maria Gallardin.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Professor Jim White, how to respond to climate change deniers. When the Weather and Climate Summit was established in 1985, the goal was to bring together weathercasters and meteorologists from the US and Canada with scientists and researchers. Their annual summit of 2017 was held in Breckenridge, Colorado, from January 8 to 12. One of the many topics at the summit was to prepare for the incoming Trump administration that includes outspoken climate change deniers. Dr. Jim White teaches at the University of Colorado. He specializes in global change, paleoclimate dynamics, and the human impact on climate. In a very entertaining and easy-to-understand way, he addressed the five topics climate change deniers most often bring up. How can we insignificant humans change the climate? How can something like CO2 that is in such low concentrations have such an impact? And by the way, isn't CO2 good for plants? We've seen about 1 degree of warming. Why worry about such a small change? I heard there was no warming recently for several years. Does that prove climate change isn't happening? Here is Dr. Jim White, Director of the Institute for Arctic and Alpine Research at the University of Colorado.
How can something like CO2 that is in such low concentration have such an impact? Shorter answer is that things that come in small sizes have big impacts. I mean, if you look at the radiative balance of the planet on the large scale, the Earth's temperature without greenhouse gases, these small amounts of gases in the atmosphere, would be about negative 18 degrees C. We know this. We have satellites at the top of the atmosphere that tell us this is how much solar energy we're getting. And if we were just a rock in outer space with no atmosphere, we would be about negative 18 degrees C on average. Now, the Earth's temperature with thermometers taken out there is about 15 degrees. And the difference between negative 18 and plus 15, about 33 degrees C, is the impact of these very small amounts of gases that are in the atmosphere, these greenhouse gases. They raise the temperature of the planet by a large amount, okay? And that's a good thing, right? So we need to recognize that. If we didn't have greenhouse gases, we would not be a liquid planet. We would be a frozen planet. So when I get this question about how can something that's 400 parts per million make a difference, we'll talk about water. The average percentage of water vapor in the atmosphere over the U.S. is about 1%. You've got crops, you've got plants, you've got precipitation, you've got, you know, wonderful, lovely green things that exist because of 1%. Again, when I get that question, how can something at 400 parts per million make a big difference? Well, how can something at 1% totally change the surface of North America? And the answer is small things have big impacts. Number four, we've seen about 1 degree C of warming. Why worry about such a small change? And this is one of the more important questions, I think. And I really like it when I get this question. I think it shows that people are thinking about this, you know. 1 degree, is that really significant? Is that really important? All right, so let's take a look at what 1 degree means. So we think that during the various interglacial periods that existed, about 120,000, 140,000, 240,000, et cetera, roughly every 100,000 years in the past, we think it was warmer during many of those, including the last one. And we have fairly good records accessing the last interglacial period. We think it was about 2 degrees C warmer at that time. Okay. Now, that's helpful because I'll loop back and I'll show you what are some of the key metrics in terms of how the planet looked with 2 degrees of warming. I would point out, by the way, so 2 degrees is not a number that I'm just pulling out of my head. 2 degrees is what, you know, right now the global leaders are arguing over whether or not we can achieve a plateau at 2 degrees. And some people are saying, no, it's got to be 1.5. So 2 is an important number here. If you go back about 3 to 5 million years ago, you'll find the planet was warmer at that time by about 2 degrees. This is fairly well documented. This is ocean bugs that live out there that record temperature. And 5 million years is quite accessible in the ocean sediment record. So we're pretty confident that if you go back 4 or 5 million years ago, you get temperatures about 2 degrees warmer. By the way, 3 to 5 million years ago, CO2 levels were about 400 parts per million. If you go back farther in time, you'll find that if you go back about 40 million years, the planet was about 4 degrees warmer than today. That's a significant point in Earth's history because Antarctica started roughly at that point in time. So if you go back about 40 million years, and that's when the planet cooled off enough that Antarctica started. So is 2 degrees significant? And the short answer is yes. Right? It was about 2 degrees warmer in the last interglacial period. Sea level was about 5 meters higher at that point. Right? 5 meters higher at 2 degrees. That was about 1,000 years of warmer time. Right? So keep in mind that it takes a while to melt ice, and we'll talk about that in a minute. It was about 4 degrees warmer when the Antarctic ice sheet did not exist, and sea level was about 80 meters higher at that point. So there's about, between Antarctica and Greenland, there's about 80 meters of sea level that's been taken out of the ocean and put down as land ice in Antarctica and Greenland. And that's an important lesson for, again, you know, those of us who look at deep Earth's history, this is like no big deal. Yeah, constantly we have sea level rising or falling and land ice doing the opposite. That's just the way the planet functions. But for many people, the idea that sea level could be 80 meters higher, you know, when you actually look at the maps, it's like, this is one of those holy moments. In the last 40 million years, the full range of temperature change has been about 10 degrees C. That includes no ice sheets, and that includes large glaciations. So, no, 2 is not insignificant. 2 is a decent part of 10. Right? If you take away the glacial side of that, which is about 6 degrees, it got 6 degrees colder during the last glacial period. The warming that we've seen over the last 40 million years was about 4 degrees. And we saw huge changes on the surface of the planet that accompanied that 4 degrees. So no, 2 degrees is not insignificant, and 1 degree is not insignificant. I've heard there's been no warming for several years. Does that prove climate change is not happening? No. Physics still applies, all right? Global climate depends on 3 factors. We know this. How much energy we get from the sun, that's physics. How much of that energy is reflected back to outer space by the white bits, physics. And the amount of greenhouse gas, which is controlled by molecular vibrations, again, physics. Right. So if you increase the amount of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, you will change the amount of energy in the atmosphere, and you will change, therefore, the climate on the planet, because the climate on the planet is indeed the energy in the atmosphere. Our focus tends to be on air temperatures, because we live in the atmosphere. The ocean community thinks we're pretty, you know, selfish, and we the fish out there, you know, they get together occasionally and say bad things about us. But the fact is, you know, 90-something percent of the heat capacity at the surface of the Earth is in the oceans. Ocean heat content has been increasing. And the reason for that is that as you accumulate greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, you accumulate energy in the atmosphere. As you accumulate energy in the atmosphere, it has to go someplace. And it can go to evaporation, it can go to temperature. If it's going to go to temperature, it's going to warm the ocean up. And if we got a good accounting of how the ocean is behaving, you'll see that this keeps going up over time. So the atmospheric temperature is really the tail. It's the ocean that's the dog. And we need to pay attention to the ocean. And you can see on there, yes, indeed, the atmospheric temperatures slowed down their growth. And that's what you expect. You expect that on a planet that is 70% ocean. When you have times in which cold water circulating up to the surface, it air conditions the atmosphere. When you have times when deep ocean is not being allowed up to the surface, the surface ocean warms up very quickly, and you end up with a much warmer planet. This is what a phenomenon of El Nino and La Nina. All right, so we know this. There will be times when atmospheric temperatures bounce around a little bit, but they are the 7-8% of the heat capacity. If you really want to understand what the planet is doing, you need to understand the ocean. Part of the message of change is that it takes a generation or two for, you know, what we put in the atmosphere to have its full impact on the planet, because it takes a while to warm up the ocean. We argue about when did the Anthropocene start? When did human beings really reach a point where they were the number one thing on the planet? It's really in the 1980s where the amount of greenhouse gas in the atmosphere really begins to shoot up. The warming, particularly that followed that time, we can't attribute to anything but the increase in greenhouse gases, which are a human-caused thing.
That was Dr. Jim White, Director of the Institute for Arctic and Alpine Research at the University of Colorado. He spoke at the annual conference of the Weather and Climate Summit before meteorologists and TV and radio weathercasters. They met in Breckenridge, Colorado, from January 8 to 12, 2017. Dr. White was preparing the audience, and now you as well, for challenges by climate change deniers. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Time of useful consciousness is an aeronautical term. It's the time between the beginning of oxygen deficiency and the loss of consciousness. Time for useful projects to rescue the planet and the plane. My name is Maria Gelerden. Thank you for listening.
That was Maria Gelerden. Check out all her past shows. It's time for me to check out as well this week. Get any or all of our past programs as free MP3 downloads from my website at ecoshock.org. I'm Alex Smith. Please join me again next time for Radio EcoShock.